The first scheduled argument this morning is number 21-1371, Western Plastics Incorporated against Dubose Strapping Incorporated. Mr. Williams.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. My name is Tom Williams. I am counsel for Dubose Strapping from Grand Rapids. I'm from McGarry-Bear in Grand Rapids, Michigan, and Dubose Strapping is from Clinton, North Carolina. We're here today to appeal some rulings and a jury verdict that happened in the District of Eastern District of North Carolina in 2019. I'd like to start on the topic of obviousness, if I may, but I would like to put kind of the scope and content of prior art in context. The patent, the 304 patent, has a number of asserted claims in this case. Every element in the asserted claims 1, 8 through 13, and 22 and 23 is an item that is off the shelf that is in the prior art. The structure described in the 304 patent has three layers. Two layers of stretch film, and in between those two layers of stretch film is sandwiched a netting structure, which is described in the 304 patent as longitudinal ribs that are connected with lateral ribs. And those longitudinal ribs and lateral rib structure combine to limit the overall stretch of the wrap. The lateral ribs and longitudinal ribs is off-the-shelf bale netting.
Counsel, yeah. There's a jury verdict in this case, right?
Yes.
So really, I think the question as I see it in the obvious inquiry is whether there's substantial evidence to support the finding by the jury that the ribs do not have stretching properties that limit stretching of the wrap, right?
Correct.
And so what is your view on whether there's substantial evidence?
Every single element of prior art limits the overall stretch of the wrap. Stretch film stretches, according to the testimony at trial, 200%, 300%.
What about the Sherrill patent itself, which I believe was the prior art you were relying on, saying that that inner layer does not impede the stretching of the first and second plies? And there's expert testimony interpreting that to say that that means that its stretchability is actually less. It doesn't limit the stretching of the outer layers.
I think, again, putting that in context of what that netting would do in between two layers of stretch film. There, according to Todd Palmer, the president of Tamanet, who testified at trial, there are no nettings that stretch as much as stretch film. Commercial stretch film stretches 200% plus. The netting that he referenced at trial, they said in a lab, the best they've been able to do is about 75%. So
what is your basis for ignoring the contrary testimony? That is the testimony of the expert who said that, you know, this sentence from Sherrill that I've quoted means that it doesn't satisfy the claim limitation.
And this expert, I believe, testified prior to trial, not at trial.
Okay. Admitted the jury heard that testimony, right?
The jury heard testimony from Mr. Sherrill himself, who was the inventor on the 909 patent, who said that that impeding statement was not meant that it would stretch the entire length of the stretch film. The impeding meant that the netting would simply not break when the wrap was used on an automated wrap machine, and as it wrapped around a steel coil, the netting wouldn't break because it wouldn't accomplish its function if the netting snapped because it was stretched too much during the wrapping process. And so Mr. Sherrill testified through video at trial that that impeding statement simply meant that the stretch was to be enough to stretch and maintain some tension as the wrap was used around the steel coil, but not that the netting was so incredibly stretchable that it would stretch the entire length of the stretch film. And that reading is a misconstruction of the language in the patent because there is no netting that stretches as much as stretch film. The netting stretch, the 5G, 6G products, those strands stretch about 5 to 15%. The Tamanet product stretches 40 to 60%. These are the ranges that those nettings, when mounted between stretch film, stretch.
So it's your view that Mr. Clark's declaration should be disregarded as a matter of fact?
Mr. Clark's declaration before the Patent Office?
Yes.
Mr. Clark's declaration before the Patent Office has a number of factual misstatements in it.
And that your view is that the jury could not rely on that. And I guess your view is that the examiner's determination about what Cheryl teaches should be disregarded.
The examiner initially took the exact same view that Mr. Cheryl did in interpreting that statement, that impeding was simply enough to stretch around when making the rejection.
The problem I'm having with your argument is that there is some contrary evidence that the jury found. And so I feel like you're trying to there is some contrary evidence that the jury could have relied on to make an alternate finding to the one that you're suggesting. And so I'm trying to figure out what you want to do us to do with that evidence.
Well, I believe the evidence that states that there's nettings that stretch as much as stretch film is simply not true.
Okay.
And that would be an opinion on products that simply don't exist. And so the differences between the scope and content of the prior art and the claimed invention in the 304 patent, there are no differences. The prior art stretch films and bale netting have the longitudinal strands, they have the lateral strands, and they limit stretch of the wrap when mounted in between two layers of stretch film.
Does the prior art stretch substantially more than the patent?
I believe the prior art stretches less than the patent. And so the...
Okay, finish your answer.
Thank you, Your Honor. There's multiple items of prior art. There's the stretch film and bale netting. The bale netting stretches less than stretch film and would limit the overall stretch of the wrap when it's mounted in between stretch film. The 5G and 6G products are pressed, they're strands that are pressed between two layers of stretch film. Those stretch only about 5 to 15%. And the Orpin reference is another reference which shows strands and mesh in between layers of stretch film. And that limits the overall stretch of the wrap. And all of these reinforcements, because they're thicker than the stretch film, limit the overall stretch of the wrap. And so the only difference that was argued at the point of novelty in the prosecution of the application was that the difference between the claimed invention and the prior art was that the claimed invention limits the overall stretch of the wrap, has the stretching properties which limit the overall stretch of the wrap. And every single reinforcement used in the prior art limits the overall stretch in the wrap. They have those same stretching properties because, according to the Markman opinion, the stretching properties need mean nothing more than the elongation to break of the netting is less than the elongation to break of the stretch film. And so every single prior art reference has that limitation. They attempted to claim that the lateral strands were a patentable feature before the examiner. That was rejected. And then what they ended up claiming was that the stretching properties have to limit the overall stretch of the wrap. That feature is in the prior art. And I believe the...
Well, but we're not talking anticipation, right? So the jury would have had to find not just that all these various components were in the prior art, but they would have combined them in the particular way that the patent did.
And I believe the Cheryl 909 patent at column 6, lines 5 through 14, provides that basis to combine netting and stretch film. And then it becomes a simple KSR analysis.
Well, but here's the problem. I mean, if this was all in the prior art and was all obvious, then why wasn't your client just practicing the prior art instead of copying the patented invention?
Our client absolutely believed he was copying the prior art.
Sure, but there's differing testimony on that, and the jury clearly found otherwise in its black box verdict. I personally, think you have a pretty good obviousness case, but we're not sitting de novo on this. We're reviewing whether there's any reason, and there's not just the actual disclosures and the combination, but there is also commercial success and copying evidence that the jury could have found as secondary consideration to support a finding of non-obviousness. What do we do with all of that?
Well, I believe the secondary considerations are not secondary considerations at all. The long-felt need, these products started being made when the automated wrapping machine started being used in the late 1990s, early 2000s. Mr. Sherrell's patent was filed in 2003. So we're talking
Okay, let's not talk about long-felt need. Let's talk about commercial success. It was commercially successful. Let's talk about copying. And I know you don't think it was copied, but I think there's evidence to suggest that it is copied.
I believe commercial success had nothing to do with the product itself, but the fact that ITW was the sole U.S.
distributor. It doesn't matter what you believe or I believe. It's what evidence the jury was given that they could have relied on. And I just don't understand why that in itself is not sufficient.
The commercial success, the product was not successful when GlobalPro was distributing it early on in its life. ITW had relationships with every single steel mill in the United States, and the product sales increased when ITW bought GlobalPro and then began distributing it. And so when ITW had 90% of the market, suddenly all of the steel mills had that product available to purchase from it. And that also goes to...
I understand, and I understand that's your view of the evidence, but I'm pretty sure that when you sit down, your friend on the other side is going to get up and give a different view of the commercial success evidence. And if as long as that evidence is in the record, what can we do about this case?
You should only get to the secondary considerations if you have an obvious invention in the first place. And there are the long-felt need, the commercial success... failure of others, there were actually successful products going on. So there's no failure of others in this area. And it has to be related to the feature that was patentable, and that is the limitation of stretch. That limitation of stretch was already in the prior art. There was no structure that stretched as much as the stretch film did when reinforced.
Okay, let's hear from the other side. You have your rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Forbes.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, I'm Glenn Forbes, representing Western Plastics. So I think the questions from the bench are appropriate because this was a jury trial. And the question before the Court is not to relitigate the issue as if we were before the Patent Office making arguments of by attorneys, but to look at what the evidence supported and was there sufficient evidence to support the jury's findings on the questions of fact.
But why isn't it just a logical conclusion, as your friend seems to suggest, that any time you sandwich any kind of netting within two plastic layers, that it's going to limit stretchability? It may limit it to lesser or larger degrees, but isn't it just common sense that something that's mesh is going to limit stretching?
So the first question is the Markman consideration was for that term was that the mesh would stretch less than the film. Okay, that was the Markman construction, which is not in debate today. And so there's no evidence in the record of a person of ordinary skill in the art or otherwise suggesting that would have been common sense. You know, and I think that what's important here is starting with the very first factor of Graham, which is who is the person of ordinary skill in the art? You know, that's one of the factors that must have been presented at. There had to be evidence of that. And the record is devoid of that. And when you look at the briefing, even here at the Federal Circuit, my opponent doesn't even point to one iota of evidence of who that person of ordinary skill in the art is.
But what is your evidence that would support the jury verdict?
So in the first instance, the evidence that we have that would support the jury's verdict is one, of course, it's not our burden of proof, right? So it is what was the evidence that supported the obviousness argument from the defendant. And we would say that there's no testimony that would suggest that it was an obvious combination from any person of ordinary skill in the art. The record is devoid of that. There's no evidence of who a person of ordinary skill in the art is in the very first place. Now, we went beyond that, right? And we presented affirmative evidence that it was not obvious, even though we didn't have to. I think that they failed in their proofs to meet their clear and convincing burden. But we went beyond that. Mr. Clark testified that this wasn't just, you know, putting two things together. There was inventive effort that went into it. Yes, he did it in 24 hours, but it was still inventive effort of determining what the relative stretching of the middle layer was to the outside layers to make it so that it could stretch enough to wrap a metal coil, but still limit the stretching of the wrap.
But why doesn't Cheryl disclose that claim element?
Okay, because Cheryl discloses exactly the opposite. Right. Cheryl, as the patent office found, discloses that the wrap or that the mesh or scrim does not impede the stretching of the wrap. It's just the opposite of what's claimed in the Western Plastics patent. Now, that's not, you know, has been made out throughout this whole case some sort of accidental or improper construction or understanding of what that term means. So if you look, and we cited it in our brief, the Cheryl 909 patent wasn't directed just to metal coils. The Cheryl 909 patent taught that it is directed to wrapping a wide range of products, pallets of plastic bottles, plastic extruded parts. And so in those instances, there was testimony at the trial that you want the wrap to expand, to stretch as much as possible, right? Because it's all about how much yield can you get from the wrap to wrap up these pieces of plastic on a pallet. And so you wouldn't want that inner mesh to restrict the stretching of the wrap, okay? And if you look, and that's in column 7 of the 909 patent where it talks about that. So the patent office, the examiner's construction of that language of reviewing the 909 patent prior art was absolutely correct. The jury heard evidence of that, and they were able to and entitled to conclude the same thing, that the 909 patent was directed to the exact opposite, a mesh that did not restrict the stretching of the wraps.
So is the principal argument that even though it was a small change, that the benefits were unexpected?
That's where I was going next, absolutely. Because, yes, in retrospect, it's one of those inventions where if you stand back and you look, you know, at what happened, well, wasn't it obvious that, you know, if you put this layer between this layer, et cetera. But that's hindsight. And Mr. Clark also testified at trial that there were unexpected results as a result of this combination, right? He didn't know going into it that you'd be able to wrap the steel coils at a lesser tension, which improved the wrapping of the steel coils because when you stretch the film less, you're less likely to get holes in the wrap. But at the same time, you have enough stretchability in there that you can wrap the coil. So he had unexpected results. And finally, it was not expected necessarily that the way you had the longitudinal and transverse ribs would prevent the zippering once you got a hole into the wrap. Would prevent zippering of that hole like a, you know, basically the tear propagating along, right? So that was another unexpected result that he testified to at trial. And finally, you know, he testified about this idea that once he had it built, he could see it acted as a fail-safe, right? Because sometimes these wrapping machines malfunction or the settings aren't right. And if they wrap it too much, if they stretch it too much, the inner mesh would break and give a visual indicator to the operator that there was a problem and they would stop the wrapping. And that's important because when you wrap these multi-million dollar steel coils and you put them on the back of a truck, you don't want there to be any hole in there, right? You want to be perfectly wrapped because otherwise it'll rust and destroy the value of that coil, okay? And then finally, the other evidence of non-obviousness is all of the secondary considerations. Commercial success. Mr. Kellerman himself, right, said this is our premier product in the industry. He said, and not only did he say that, right, but he backed it up with his actions because he migrated customers that he had in ITW in 2010 and 11, migrated them from products that ITW was making to the new product, to the new Panacea product. So not only did he say that it was a premier product, and not only did the commercial success show in the sales, But Kellerman was moving products or moving customers from the 6G, 5G products to the new Panacea product. The copying is, you know, we've briefed that extensively. We think that Mr. Kellerman absolutely copied the Panacea product. He was motivated to do that. He did it. There's evidence that he talked to suppliers about how to make the product like Panacea. They tested the Panacea product for the stretching capability, and then they made it. 1 second. And the last thing is this idea that there weren't any wraps that or any meshes that stretched more than the films. What Mr. Williams probably means is that there weren't a lot of those commercially available, right? Because we all know, and there was evidence at trial, that you could make custom wrap, you could make custom films that stretched less than the mesh. You could make mesh to stretch more than the films. And in fact, Mr. Clark testified at trial that there were, in fact, available products on the market like that, to the extent you wanted to only rely on commercial products.
Do you have a record site for that?
I do. I will get that to you on my reply. I want to spend a little bit of my time now on the combination of willfulness and how it applies to our counter appeal for exceptional case. So we've detailed extensively in our briefing what we believe to be egregious willful conduct. And this is not a case where Mr. Kellerman, who was responsible for bringing this product to market, it's not a case where he, you know, took a risk or, you know, it was close. He copied the product.
Isn't that what the willfulness finding gets you, though? I mean, here's my problem with this is, you know, first of all, you've got a really good standard review for you on the obviousness issue. You've got a really bad standard review for you on this, right? Except case we review for abuse of discretion.
Correct.
The obviousness question to me seems a very, very close question. And the fact that you won means you won and you showed copying and you got willfulness damages, but that doesn't show that this case was so frivolous or egregiously out of the norm that you should get attorney's fees, does it? It just shows that you were, you know, successful in convincing the jury of your view of the facts. Why is that an exceptional case?
So the reason we believe that this is an exceptional case is because it's not a run-of-the-mill willfulness case. This is a case where Mr. Kellerman...
Let me just ask, because is this where you're going? Do you think that there's just no possible way that they could have ever proved obviousness here?
Well, no, I don't think that... there was clearly questions of fact about obviousness, and it went to the jury. Okay, so the jury could have concluded, you know, based upon the evidence, et cetera, they could have concluded perhaps either way. I don't know, right? But that's not the issue, right? Because the obviousness case that was presented at trial was not something that Mr. Kellerman relied upon at the time of the willfulness. This was an obviousness case that was developed during litigation. Mr. Kellerman relied upon one thing and one thing only.
Right, that's why it can't defeat the willfulness finding, but it can still defeat an exceptional case finding in the way this case was litigated, can't it?
I don't disagree.
I mean, at least it's not an abuse of discretion.
Our case for...
What do you think the abuse of discretion here is?
So I think the abuse of discretion was the misweighing of the evidence.
Aren't you out there immediately when you talk about weighing evidence?
What's that?
Aren't you out immediately on an abuse of discretion standard when you talk about misweighing evidence?
No, I mean,
that's stuff that the Supreme Court has told us to lead to the district courts.
Yep.
Well, I think there has to be basically one view of how this should have come out for an exceptional case finding. Maybe not all that way, but it has to be pretty close, doesn't it?
Well, our point on exceptional case is only on the willfulness. It's not on the rest of it. And our point is this, and it's simply this. You have a case where Mr. Kellerman went to two lawyers, and he was told the product that you're going to bring to market is a problem. And if you're going to bring it to market, you need to shore up this invalidity case based upon the prototype, which they never did. And so as this case stands, in my opinion, you have a situation where a defendant goes to a lawyer, and I'm not saying going to the lawyer was the problem. He went to the lawyer. The lawyer told him, if you make this particular type of product where the mesh stretches less than the film, you've got a problem. So shore up the invalidity case based upon the prototype, and he couldn't do it. That's the problem. And, you know, one thing is willfulness if it is you're taking an extreme risk and you knew or should have known that there was infringement.
Can you bring this back around to it? I mean, it still seems to me you're talking about willfulness.
We are.
Bring it back around to why that means that the district court should have awarded attorney fees for finding this an exceptional case.
Like I said, the reason is because as it stands.
Can you give me any precedent to suggest that willfulness alone pre-litigation is sufficient for an exceptional case finding too?
We cited precedent in our brief that willfulness is one of the factors to consider in an exceptional case.
But we've also held that willfulness does not dictate
a course, exceptional case. Of course. Willfulness does not mandate an exceptional case. And the only reason we're here on the exceptional case issue isn't because it's willful. It was because it was willful in the sense of you were told, not that you should have known, but you were told this was going to be a problem product by a lawyer, and you took it to market anyways. That's the problem. And in my view...
But that's true in almost all willfulness cases. It seems to me the rule you're advocating would end up with an exceptional case award in every case where willfulness was found found. And that just isn't the law, is it?
That's not the law. But I'm not aware. I have not been involved in, and I'm not aware of cases where
Let's just assume I think that the invalidity question here was close, and it was basically a 50-50 toss-up. Even if they knew if they lost, they were going to be found to have willfully infringed because they copied it, aren't they entitled to go forward and put on a very good invalidity defense without being subject to exceptional case findings?
I would say under normal circumstances, yes. Again, the reason I go back to exceptional case here is, as it stands on the willfulness side, right, it's so egregious, in my opinion, right, that we have a case out there now that says if you get an opinion from a lawyer, patent lawyer, who tells you that you've got a problem and you go forward, that's not exceptional. That's a normal case. And I think that that's problematic.
It seems like it is a normal case sometimes. And you get compensated for that by getting the willfulness damages. They took their risks about going forward and willfully infringing when they thought they might have a potential invalidity claim.
I understand, Your Honor. So with that, I can answer any other questions with my time left. Otherwise, I'm complete. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, Mr. Williams.
Thank you, Your Honors. I believe this is not an exceptional case. I'd like to start with the last issue. There's no conduct that was pointed to by the district court that we acted in anything but in an exemplary manner. When the Markman opinion came out, we offered to stipulate to infringement as a defendant. And after that, the judge pointed to no discovery disputes. The judge indicated that our positions were reasonable, even if ultimately unsuccessful at the district court level, and did not point to any bad faith behavior whatsoever, and could only compliment us at the district court level. So I believe that the exceptional case motion is completely unavailing. Some comments on willfulness. I do believe that the willfulness finding discounted what we are even referring to in this room today as a toss-up on invalidity. A substantial invalidity position can be mitigating with respect to willfulness. And Mr. Kellerman was not copying the panacea product.
It is a highly factual issue, though, right? And the Supreme Court has said that that objective factor you're referring to cannot be something that eliminates a willfulness finding, right?
Yes, Your Honor. I absolutely agree with that. It is a highly fact-intensive analysis. But when weighed with all of the facts that Mr. Kellerman was at ITW in 2003, was an inventor on the Shirell patent, knew that the Tamanet was made between stretch film, that was used at trials at, the documents show at least it was intended to be used at trials at steel mills, and was told by an attorney, if you make what you made at ITW in 2003, that is a safe harbor. And when he went to Tamanet to seek out product to put in between the stretch film, he was tried to be upsold by the president of Tamanet to get their latest and greatest product. He turned that down because he said, I want what you sold us at ITW in 2003. His state of mind was not one that says, boy, give me your best product. He was following the lawyer's advice to say, give me what you gave me in 2003 because that's what I'm going to make. He also made some design around attempts during the litigation to try and avoid infringement and resolve the case. And I believe those are also mitigating factors. But again, I do concede it's a highly fact-intensive analysis. If there's no other questions, that is my time.
Any more questions for Mr. Williams? Any more? Thank you. Thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under submission. Waive your argument on the cross appeal. Since you didn't mention it in your case, do you want to hear argument on the cross appeal and attorney's fees?
I think he did mention it.
He did mention the exceptional case.
Yes, he mentioned it.
I did address the exceptional case on the, in the original.
Oh, all right. Proceed.
I mean, if you have stuff on that, what you're about to give us isn't exceptional case stuff, is it?
No, it's not.
But I had asked for a case
okay.
site.
Okay, yeah,
if
right.
you could just give me the case
site. So the, you asked for case for record sites to where Clark testified about other types of mesh that could be made in films. That's at Appendix 5822 through 5823. And that's lines... 41 or page 41, lines 1 through 22. Also at Appendix 5824 through 5926. That's at page 43, line 12 through page 45, line 17.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Your
okay.
Honor.
Well, Your Honor, thank you very much. We would submit rest on our briefs for all other issues.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.